From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now.
The interior minister is just furious, and he said that, you know, Khan is the kind of asset that could eventually have led to bin Laden himself had he not been outed.
Pakistan and Britain accuse the White House of sabotaging the war on terror by leaking the name of an al-Qaeda double agent. We'll speak with Middle East expert Juan Cole about the case. World-renowned writer Salman Rushdie, who lived under a fatwa for years, speaks about terrorism, intellectual freedom, and the USA Patriot Act.
Will we become our enemy or not? Will we become repressive as our enemy is repressive? Will we become intolerant as our enemy is intolerant? Or will we not? Will we fight with different weapons? Weapons of openness and acceptance and seeking to increase the dialogue between peoples rather than decrease it.
And President Bush responds to a question from a Native American journalist about what tribal sovereignty is in the 21st century.
Tribal sovereignty means that. It's sovereign. It means you've been given sovereignty and you're viewed as a sovereign entity.
We'll speak with the Native American journalist who asked the question. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry said yesterday he still would have voted to authorize the war in Iraq, even if he had known then that no weapons of mass destruction would be found. Kerry said, quote, "Yes, I would have voted for the authority. I believe it was the right authority for a president to have." Kerry was responding to a challenge laid down by President Bush last Friday for Kerry to clarify his position, including why he voted for the congressional resolution authorizing the invasion, yet opposed funding for it. While Kerry continues to support the occupation of Iraq, he said his goal as president would be to reduce the number of U.S. troops deployed there during his first 6 months in office through diplomacy and foreign assistance. A roadside bomb apparently aimed at a U.S. military convoy exploded near hotels used by foreigners in central Baghdad early Tuesday. But Iraqi police said there were no casualties. Overnight, resistance forces fired a dozen mortars or rockets in central Baghdad aimed at the Green Zone compound housing the interim Iraqi government and U.S. and British embassies. A series of strong explosions were also heard in Baghdad today, coming from the direction of the Sadr City neighborhood. In the Shiite holy city of Najaf, fresh fighting broke out, with explosions and gunfire coming from the heart of the city, where Mehdi army fighters, lawyer to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, are dug in. Iraqi officials have reportedly given U.S. military commanders permission to strike the holy shrine in Najaf, where some members of the Mehdi army are based. Meanwhile, news agencies out of the city say residents are rejecting a curfew and are vowing to fight the U.S. forces. The Los Angeles Times reports today the U.S. has taken operational control of Iraqi troops in the city. Serious questions are being raised about a raid on a mosque in Albany, New York, last week and was hailed as a victory in the so-called war on terror. Two leaders of the mosque were arrested in a sting operation and were indicted on charges of conspiring to launder money and conceal a plot to use a shoulder-fired weapon to kill Pakistan's ambassador to the United Nations. But it now appears there was no actual plot. It turns out the two men from the mosque were dealing with an FBI informant who's a convicted felon trying to get a reduced sentence in an unrelated fraud case. According to court documents reviewed by the Financial Times, conversations taped by the FBI informant show Mohammed Musharraf Hussein and Yassin Muhyiddin Arif were lured into receiving $5,000 for helping the informant launder $45,000. As part of the sting operation, The informant invented the story he'd earned the money from smuggling an anti-aircraft weapon into the U.S., and that was to be used to strike the Pakistani consulate in New York or hit its ambassador. But the official indictment also reveals one of the men told the FBI informant that now is not the time for violent jihad or struggle, and that importing such weapons is illegal. Both accused refused a request to help transport the smuggled weapon through New York. A federal judge in Washington held a reporter for Time magazine in contempt of court yesterday and ordered him jailed for refusing to name the government officials who disclosed the identity of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame to him. The magazine was also held in contempt and ordered to pay a fine of $1,000 a day. The judge, Thomas Hogan, suspended both sanctions while Time and its reporter, Matthew Cooper, pursued an appeal. But the judge firmly rejected their contention that the First Amendment entitles journalists to refuse to answer a grand jury's questions about confidential sources. Legal experts said yesterday the potential jailing of a journalist represents perhaps the most significant clash between federal prosecutors and the news media since the 1970s. The case is one of several making its way through federal courts in which journalists have been ordered to reveal their sources. Like Cooper, Tim Russert of NBC's Meet the Press received a subpoena in May, but unlike Cooper, Russert agreed to cooperate. In a statement, NBC said Russert was interviewed under oath by prosecutors on Saturday. A Washington Post reporter, Glenn Kessler, was interviewed by prosecutors in June. A second Washington Post reporter, Walter Pink, says he received a subpoena yesterday. Japanese police are investigating Kansai Electric Power for possible negligence leading to the deadliest accident at a nuclear power plant ever in Japan. The company had not thoroughly inspected the cooling pipe that exploded and killed four people. Officials claim no radiation leaked during the accident. Following the lead of the Bush administration, the European Union said yesterday it does not consider the widespread violence in Sudan to be genocide. EU foreign policy chief Javier Solana did say that, quote, it is clear there's widespread silent and slow killing and village burning of a fairly large scale. There are considerable doubts as to the willingness of Sudan's government to assume its duty to protect its civilian population against attacks, Solana said. He cited unwillingness to send a significant military force, saying the EU and others are being forced to cooperate with the Khartoum government. Last month, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 422-0 to describe the situation in Darfur as genocide. Amnesty International and other groups are reporting between 40 and 150 construction workers have died in Athens due to poor safety measures leading up to the Olympics, scheduled to begin this Friday. Union officials say there's no official record being kept of the deaths. City authorities are also reportedly rounding up homeless people, drug addicts, and mentally ill people and requiring that psychiatric hospitals lock them up. Also affected by Athens' Olympic cleanup are refugees and asylum seekers, some of whom are being targeted for detention and deportation in the days leading up to the Games. And as the city makes preparation to welcome athletes, prisoners of the Korydallos prison and five other prisons have protested against the government's decision to stop authorizing parole during the Games as a security measure. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting over 240 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations on PBS, as well as on both satellite networks. Free Speech TV, which is Channel 9415, Free Speech TV Dish Network, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. If you'd like to bring us to your community, go to our website, democracynow.org, and find out how. New York Senator Chuck Schumer is asking the White House to explain how and why the name of an Al-Qaeda informant arrested in Pakistan last month was leaked to the press. The name of computer expert Mohammad Naeem Noor Khan first appeared in the New York Times last week. Pakistani intelligence sources are accusing the Bush administration of undermining its fight against Al-Qaeda by revealing Khan's name while he was still working as an undercover double agent. Unnamed U.S. officials leaked his name to the press in an attempt of the Bush administration to defend last week's heightened terror threat level. In a letter to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Senator Schumer said the disclosure of Khan's capture may have complicated efforts to combat terror. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting a new portrait of Al-Qaeda's inner workings is emerging from information seized after Khan's arrest. The Times says intelligence analysts find that a new generation of Al-Qaeda operatives appears to be filling a vacuum created when leaders were killed or captured. The information reveals a far more complex picture of Al-Qaeda than President Bush has presented on his campaign trail, where he's claimed that much of Al-Qaeda's leadership has been killed or captured. To talk about the story of the exposing of Mohammad Khan, we caught up with Middle East analyst Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, runs an analytical website called Informed Comment, in which he provides a daily roundup of news and events in Iraq and elsewhere in the Arab world. Cole speaks fluent Arabic and Persian and has lived around the Muslim world for extended periods of time. We asked him about the exposing of Mohammad Khan.
This seems to me a really big story, and it's amazing to me how little play it has gotten in the American print press, as well as the cable television news. It appears to be the case that a big break came in the Al-Qaeda investigation in Pakistan in June. They arrested a man named Rochi, who is a cousin of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the key Al-Qaeda lieutenants. And Rochi, in turn, gave up a younger man, 25 years old, named Mohammad Naeem Noor Khan, who was living in Lahore and was a computer whiz. He was a hacker. And he had been providing electronic communication services to Al-Qaeda and some of the leadership, which is in the wilds of the no man's land between Afghanistan and Pakistan, had been getting him messages by courier, and he would encrypt them and put them up on the web or send them by email. And he was arrested on July 13th. And it was possible for the inter-services intelligence, Pakistan military intelligence, to turn him. So he was willing to flip and begin informing on Al-Qaeda and to keep his correspondents on the line. So they continued to correspond with him as though he were still working for bin Laden. It was from his computer files that the U.S. learned that there had been a plot against U.S. financial institutions and other plots, some of them somewhat old. And so a decision was made by the Bush White House to release this information, and Tom Ridge came out on Sunday, August 1st, and announced that there was such a plot and there would be extra security for those institutions. And in the course of the off-the-record briefing that the Homeland Security did for the press, a Bush administration official mentioned that the information had come from Mohammad Naeem Noor Khan. Now, he was still a double agent and was undercover and was sending email messages, according to Pakistani sources, on Sunday and the following Monday to his al-Qaeda contacts in London, who still thought he was on the inside. So the next day, the New York Times printed the name, and it's a principle that you don't tell the press things you don't want to see in the newspapers. And that, in turn, caused a big furor in Pakistan and the United Kingdom, where there were ongoing sting operations being run through Khan. And the British had to swoop in and arrest 13 of Khan's correspondents, lest they scatter once they heard he had been arrested. And, in fact, they lost five of them. And many they're going to have to release for lack of evidence. So the cases hadn't been made. And Faisal Saleh Hayat, who is the Pakistani Interior Minister, is just furious. And he said that, you know, Khan is the kind of asset that could eventually have led to bin Laden himself had he not been outed.
We're talking to Professor Juan Cole, his blog, juancole.com. How do you know that he was a double agent? What is this based on?
Well, there are two indications of this. First of all, this is what Pakistani intelligence sources told Reuters last Friday in Karachi. So the Pakistanis maintain it. Faisal Saleh Hayat has implicitly endorsed this information. And other Pakistani ministers, Rashid Ahmed, for instance, have admitted it. So the other thing is that it's very clear from the reaction in Britain, where people have been unwilling to come out and say this, that they are very upset. MI5 actually has given an interview in which to the New York Times, in which they have complained about the damage that was done to the ongoing cases. So both sources that have talked to journalists in Pakistan and in the United Kingdom have confirmed this story. The Bush administration officials' line on it, and Condi Rice was on CNN Sunday, was to admit that a Bush administration official did in fact provide Khan's name to the press on background, but then to say that they don't know if he was a double agent. And this just seems to me disingenuous.
Can you explain what happened with Condoleezza Rice in her interview with Wolf Blitzer, CNN, and then on background with Wolf Blitzer?
Well, that was actually a mistake on my part. In the course of his interview with her, and I have to say Wolf was on top of this story in a way that most of the television journalists have not been, he asked her about the incident, and she admitted that the name had been, in fact, provided to the press on background when the Ridge briefing was done the previous Sunday. Then she also admitted, then she said she didn't know if he was a double agent. And later in the broadcast, Wolf had two senators on, Charles Schumer and George Allen, and he said to them that Condi had admitted this to him, and I misheard him. I thought he said that she had told him something more on background, but he was referring to the fact that the reporters had been told this on background. So I'm sorry, I got that mixed up. But in any case, that the Bush administration released this name has been confirmed by the National Security Advisor, and it seems to me just unbelievable that this could happen. It is an incredible screw-up, and it endangers us all.
Explain further why it endangers everyone and why you think that the U.S. was willing to give him up even while he was undercover.
Well, to take the second question first, it seems clear to me that the Bush administration went public with what had been found on Khan's computers for political advantage. Everyone knows that whenever you mention terrorism and al-Qaeda, Bush's numbers go up. It may also be that they made a calculation that this information was likely to become public at some point during the campaign, and that if they hadn't released it, then it would look as though they weren't on the ball, or it would be used against them. So they, either for positive reasons or negative reasons, they decided to go public with it. The British political establishment is deeply critical of this decision. They don't believe it should have been made public. And Home Secretary David Blunkett has written an op-ed in The Guardian criticizing the Bush administration for having done this. But that decision was made. And then everything followed from that decision. Once you had decided to let the information out that these that we now know about these plots that were being hatched before September 11th, then, of course, the reporters are going to say, well, how do you know that? And the potential for either an inadvertent leak of the name or for a deliberate decision to leak the name just to make the case solid was there. So it all followed from this decision to go public, a decision which I think can't be entirely removed from the campaign politics.
Now, Mohammed Khan sent emails, 5 or 6 emails, is this right, to contacts in the United States?
Yes, at least this is what has been reported in the press, is that there's some evidence on his computer of 5 or 6 contacts in the U.S.
And what happens to him now? Where is he being held? What happens to the people he's contacted?
Well, you know, the intelligence and security people in each of the countries that he had contacts in are swooping in and arresting his contacts. A senior radical Islamist was hiding in Dubai, and they arrested him. He's implicated in attempts against the life of Pakistani dictator Pervez Musharraf. In Britain, they have swooped down on people. And if the information in the computer were sufficiently detailed to allow the U.S. to find the 5 or 6 people that he was talking to here, certainly they will be arrested as well. So because his name was revealed in the press, they have no choice but to attempt to arrest these people. In many instances, they may not actually have enough evidence against them to hold them, because being in email contact with Mohammed Naeem Noor Khan is not a crime.
And your read on the Ridge news conference where he announced the upping of the security alert?
Well, I believe that it probably shouldn't have been done. We now know that the information was very old. It is often said by the Bush administration officials that it had been updated as recently as January of 2004. But The Guardian has revealed now that what they really mean is that the file had been opened as recently as January 2004. No new information was added to it. We don't have evidence of ongoing operational activities. So it seems as though, in retrospect, it was old information. And, you know, I really don't want to be completely cynical about these things. I have to believe that Tom Ridge really wants to protect the United States. And so I'm reluctant to come out and say, well, he made this announcement to get Bush reelected. But it's awfully suspicious that the announcement came right after the Democratic Convention. It came on a day when churches were being bombed in Baghdad. And it came on a Sunday, so that everybody knew that it would hit the newspapers Monday morning. It would be the top line on all the newspapers in the country. And then the clumsy way it was done, and the revealing of Khan's identity, so that they dried up this potentially very rich well of further tracking and information, might have led to bin Laden himself, might have led to a very severe crippling of al-Qaeda operational capabilities, might have led to successful court cases against a whole range of operatives in London and elsewhere. In retrospect, this seems to me to have been a mistake and hard to separate from politics, at least.
Juan Cole. He has a blog, juancole.com. He's professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, President Bush on tribal sovereignty. Then we'll hear from Salman Rushdie about intellectual freedom and the USA Patriot Act. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Unity Conference wrapped up this weekend, the largest gathering of journalists in U.S. history, sponsored by the four major journalists of color organizations, the National Association of Black Journalists, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the Asian American Journalists Association, and the Native American Journalists Association. More than 8,000 journalists were there. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry addressed the conference on Thursday. We played his comments last Friday. Then on Friday, President Bush addressed the journalists. At the conference, both Kerry and Bush were questioned by a member of each of the four leading journalists of color organization. Here we play the questioning by Mark Trehant. He is the editorial page editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, former president of the Native American Journalists Association, questioning President Bush.
Most school kids learn about government in the context of city, county, state, and federal. And of course, tribal governments are not part of that at all. Mr. President, you've been a governor and a president, so you have a unique experience looking at it from two directions. What do you think tribal sovereignty means in the 21st century? And how do we resolve conflicts between tribes and the federal and state governments?
Yeah. Tribal sovereignty means that. It's sovereign. I mean, you've been given sovereignty and you're viewed as a sovereign entity.
Okay.
And therefore, the relationship between the federal government and tribes is one between sovereign entities. Now, the federal government has got a responsibility on matters like education and security to help, and health care. And it's a solemn duty. And from this perspective, we must continue to uphold that duty. I think that one of the most promising areas of all is to help with economic development. And that means helping people understand what it means to start a business. That's why the Small Business Administration's increased loans. It means, obviously, encouraging capital flows. But none of that will happen unless the education systems flourish and are strong. And that's why I told you we've spent $1.1 billion in the reconstruction of Native American schools.
President Bush speaking at the Unity Conference this past Friday. Afterwards, the Reverend Jesse Jackson held a news conference, and he was questioned by Brent Merrill of the publication Smoke Signals.
As you saw today at the President's conference, the leader of the free world does not understand tribal sovereignty. What would you do, in your estimation, Reverend, what would you do, and how would you advise tribes to educate our folks just exactly what tribal sovereignty is?
The president explain. You just didn't understand. Sovereignty is sovereignty. You understand? It's like in sovereignty. If you're on the reservation, you've been sovereignized. Your PhD is in sovereign vacation. You understand? I mean, I don't think you understand. What?
You're right. I didn't understand that.
Well, needless to say, that the sovereignty of American Native American tribes are federally protected rights. And as long as Native Americans were perishing on those reservations, it didn't matter to states. But now that you have gaming on the reservations and economic development on the reservations, indeed in some states voting on the reservations, the state now wants to impose itself on the federally protected sovereignty of the states. It has nothing to do with education per se. It has to do with a legal relationship between federally constructed contracts or treaties. And states do not have the right to interfere with those federal territories. That is the real answer to that.
That is Reverend Jesse Jackson responding to President Bush's comments after he was questioned by Mark Trehant, the former president of the Native American Journalists Association, editorial page editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And Mark Trehant joins us on the line right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you respond to President Bush's response to your question on Friday?
Well, unfortunately, it fits into a much longer pattern of presidents not being particularly well informed on this subject. When President Reagan went to Moscow, he talked about how it was too bad that America's Indians were put on preservations, and it was the biggest mistake the United States made. So presidents have a history of saying things like this, unfortunately.
Well, the issue of Native America has gotten more attention this weekend as John Kerry, after leaving the Unity Conference, has been focusing on courting the Latino and Native American vote in swings through Arizona and New Mexico. Kerry announced the formation of Native Americans for Kerry. On Sunday in Gallup, New Mexico, Kerry spoke at the closing powwow for the 83rd annual Intertribal Indian Ceremonial, with more than 30 tribes participating. Kerry pledged to promote tribal sovereignty, partner with tribes to improve access to health care. He announced he'd increase funding for the Indian Health Service and elevate the director of IHS to a senior position in the administration, also saying he would appoint at least one Native American who would have an office in the White House. Can you talk about this?
Well, the Native vote, in fact, it's interesting, Reverend Jackson was the first presidential candidate that I know of when he ran for president who actually campaigned in Indian country. He went to at least two reservations in his campaign. He spent a great deal of time on the Navajo Nation actually going to more than one place. So what we've seen in the last few years is states like Washington, South Dakota, Arizona, New Mexico, where the Native American vote has made a significant difference. There wouldn't be a Democrat governor in Oklahoma right now, Arizona, perhaps even New Mexico, not to mention the Senate race in South Dakota. And what's significant is on Indian communities, it's not just that the vote turns out like it hasn't for many years, but that it's 8, 9, 10 to 1 in one direction. And that's something that any politician likes to see.
We're talking to Mark Trehant, who is the editorial page editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, a member of Idaho's Shoshone-Bannock tribe. How many Native American journalists are there in this country?
Probably about 300, which is a huge increase from just, say, 20 years ago when there may have been 10 or 15.
Can you talk more about the significance of the Native American vote, and if you see President Bush doing the same thing that Senator Kerry is doing now, really courting the vote, paying a great deal of attention, at least for the last few days?
It's going to be hard for him to court too much. He just doesn't have policies that reflect life in tribal nations. I mean, we didn't talk some of the things we didn't talk about in his the content of what he had to say. There's a major trust fund scandal that the administration hasn't been able to get their arms around. And to be fair, it goes back many administrations, but this administration has been as inept as previous administrations in trying to figure out solutions. The Indian Health Service, which is by treaty a promise to provide health care, has been underfunded for generations. In the last, least, except for the Clinton administration, Congress has been so upset with the way the administration budgets come in that they could completely ignore them and start over. So this administration would have to go a long way just to rally people. I think one of the reasons why Arizona and New Mexico have become so much more important to Republicans is Senator John McCain has really versed himself well in American Indian issues, and particularly Southwest issues, and has earned a great deal of respect. And that started to create an inroad for Republicans, and they were hoping that it would translate into a broader picture. But I think the Bush administration has pretty much reversed that.
When we had on the presidents of all the major journalists of color organizations sponsoring Unity, Patty Talahongva, your successor as president of the National Association, the Native American Journalists Association, talked about the Indian Trust scandal, saying it's far larger than Enron and yet has gotten very little attention.
Oh, that's right. It basically, the federal judge in that case has said, unless the federal government figures this out, he's going to put the federal government's management of these trust funds, which is both land and money, into receivership. That's a pretty strong statement when a federal judge says that it's so bad that he's going to have to put it under court receivership.
Well, Mark Trahant, I want to thank you very much for being with us, of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, also a member of Idaho's Shoshone-Bannock Tribe, former president of the Native American Journalists Association, questioned President Bush on Friday at the Unity Conference. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll hear from a world-renowned writer, Salman Rushdie. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we hear a voice not often heard in this country, one of the world's most acclaimed writers, Salman Rushdie. An Indian-British novelist, Salman Rushdie's book Midnight's Children was published in 1981. It won him the Booker Prize and brought him international fame, but it was his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses, that Rushdie is most known for. One of the main characters in the book is modeled on the Muslim prophet Muhammad. The novel was quickly banned in India and South Africa. In Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa calling on Muslims to execute the writer and publishers of the book and offered a $1 million reward for Rushdie's death. Rushdie was forced into hiding and lived underground for many years. The fatwa was finally lifted in 1998, although it was lifted in 1998. In a rare appearance in the United States, Salman Rushdie spoke at an event last week sponsored by the Pen American Center, a fellowship of writers to advance literature, to promote a culture of reading, and to defend free expression. This is Salman Rushdie.
I wanted to start by saying that I don't think any of us who arrange this event delude ourselves about terrorism. Terrorism does exist. In this city of all cities, we know that. We know what it exists to do, what it has done, what it tries to do. We know that it exists and must be fought. I don't think any of us would question that. How we fight it, in my view, is going to be the great civilizational test of our time. Will we become our enemy or not? Will we become repressive as our enemy is repressive? Will we become intolerant as our enemy is intolerant? Or will we not? Will we fight with different weapons? Weapons of openness, of acceptance, and seeking to increase the dialogue between peoples rather than decrease it. This is a big test. Will we become, you could say, the suits of armor that our fear makes us put on? Or will we not? It seems to us in Penn, to many of us in the last months, that we are not passing this test very well at present. And that there are serious reasons to say that there is a crisis in this country of civil liberties, freedom of speech, and human rights of exactly the kind that Penn has spent over 80 years protesting about when it happens in other countries. But the kind of things that we have tried to highlight, whether it was in Cuba or Burma or Iran or China, those sorts of problems are beginning to crop up here. Problems of what it is possible to say without being in trouble, what it is possible to have access to the information media to talk about, the terms in which it is possible to talk about these things when one does have access to the news media, the way in which the government is becoming increasingly intrusive into areas of our lives which the government has no business to go into, what books we read, what shops we go to, what books we borrow from universities, what do we think about. That is, you know, this gets very close to the thought police and is something which is not acceptable in a free society. Right. Penn has identified three particular areas of concern in the Patriot Act and the many related laws and executive orders which have been enacted since September 11, 2001. These concerns have to do with privacy, access to information, and compliance with international law and human rights standards. And we have launched the campaign which this event is here to support, which we are calling the Campaign for Core Freedoms, in an effort to restore fundamental protections in these areas. You know, people like me came to America because of our admiration for the protections afforded by the First Amendment. And it is extremely saddening to see those protections being eroded. And so it is really not a question of left or right. It seems to me whatever kind of American you are, you should know that the First Amendment is the jewel in the crown. And to erode that is to do terrible damage to one's sense of what it is to be an American and a citizen or a resident of this country.
Salman Rushdie speaking at a Pen America event just a few days ago. Each of the authors read from other writers' works, beginning with Salman Rushdie. This is Democracy Now.
And just by way of starting that off, I'm going to read one paragraph of the great text, John Stuart Mill's text on liberty, written, well, getting on for 200 years ago, but feels fresh as a daisy. And just to the warning he offers us is that if we do not fight for our rights, we lose them. The dictum that truth always triumphs over persecution is one of those pleasant falsehoods which men repeat after one another till they pass into commonplaces, but which all experience refutes. History teems with instances of truth put down by persecution. If not suppressed forever, it may be thrown back for centuries. To speak only of religious opinions, the Reformation broke out at least 20 times before Luther and was put down. There's another very long list of such things. It is a piece of idle sentimentality that truth, merely as truth, has any inherent power denied to error of prevailing against the dungeon and the stake. Men are not more zealous for truth than they often are for error. And a sufficient application of legal or even of social penalties will generally succeed in stopping the propagation of either. The real advantage which truth has consists in this, that when an opinion is true, it may be extinguished once, twice, or many times, but in the course of ages, there will generally be found persons to rediscover it until someone of its reappearances falls on a time when, from favorable circumstances, it escapes persecution until it has made such head as to withstand all subsequent attempts to suppress it.
Salman Rushdie speaking at the PEN America event. Many authors then got up and read other writers' works, and finally Salman Rushdie concluded the evening by reading from the works of two others.
I'm going to finish just by reading two short pieces sent in by writers who were not able to be here today. The writer Francisco Goldman sent in this piece, which is written by the Cuban independence hero and poet José Martí, who was actually for a long time a New Yorker. He lived in New York from 1880 to 1895, observed the politics of the time very closely, and wrote a piece about the presidential election of 1884, which pitted James G. Blaine against Grover Cleveland and is often called the dirtiest campaign in American history. During the course of which the Republicans found that Cleveland had had a child out of wedlock, and he acknowledged paternity and won the election anyway by 48.5% to 48.2%, including Florida. And this is what Martí said about that election. It's brutal and nauseating, a presidential campaign in the United States. The mud comes up to the chairs. The white beards of the newspapers forget all about the decorum of old age. They dump buckets of mud on all our heads. They knowingly lie and exaggerate. They stab each other in the belly and the back. Any defamation is treated as legitimate. Every blow is good as long as it staggers the enemy. He who invents an effective slander proudly struts. A good faith observer has no idea how to analyze a battle in which everyone considers it legitimate to campaign in bad faith. But he who observes this country without rancor, as much as he is disgusted by the primacy ceded to the appetites here, and the forgetfulness, if not the disdain, in which the generous qualities are held, also has to recognize that whenever it appears that a danger is imminent, or that an institution has been profaned beyond redemption, or that some vice has half devoured the nation, there arises with the reliability of a law, and without great apparatus, and when the evil can still be cured, the men and systems that can avoid ruin. They appear, do what they have to do, and drop from sight. And it also appears that a condition of this law is that the evil has to be extreme, as if the prosperous peoples never decide to change direction or perturb their habits until the reality becomes so dire that it is impossible to ignore. This was the law affirmed by the election of Grover Cleveland. The evil was very grave. The Republicans entrenched in power cynically abused it. They subverted the integrity of the vote and of the press. They mocked the spirit of the Constitution through partisan legislation and copying the tactics of tyrants, and used overseas wars to deflect attention from their actions. It's history. Who had a chance to compete against them, defeat them, if elections are won by the force of money, if the Republicans have a free hand with the national coffers? But a wave rose up. that no one saw forming on the margins and no one knows how it came, breaking over the heads of all the ambitious and illustrious politicians of the nation. Despite the anger of the members of his own Democratic Party, despite time-proven practices and conceits, and landed in the White House, a man just a little more than barely known, a tough but humble man fit for the task of fearlessly and patiently reforming the corrupt government. The wave brought Cleveland. Up close, you see that the change has not been essential or durable, but circumstantial and like a proof, an eruption proving that it can be done, that the eruption of a fistful of men, a fistful of honorable people, nothing more than that, have given victory to Cleveland. 1,000 votes less among 10 million voters, and the president would have been an impure and sinister man, a brilliant sophist. He would have been Bush, sorry, Blaine. He would have been Blaine. And finally, from former president of Penn, Norman Mailer. He sent us the briefest contribution of anybody, yeah. from John Dos Passos in USA. All right then, we are two nations. However, I also wanted to read from... from what Norman said in the interview that is in the current issue of the New York magazine, a conversation with his son. And this is how it ends. Norman writes, or says, "Wisdom is ready to reach us from the most unexpected quarters. Here I quote from a man who became wise a little too late in life. Naturally, the common people don't want war. But after all, it is the leaders of a country who determine the policy. And it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. This is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country." That was Hermann Göring speaking at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. It is one thing to be forewarned. Will we ever be forearmed? Thank you.
Author Salman Rushdie speaking at an event sponsored by the Penn American Center at Cooper Union in New York. And finally, as we reported in the headlines at the top of the hour, a federal judge in Washington is holding Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper in contempt of court and has ordered him jailed for refusing to name the government officials who disclosed the identity of undercover operative Valerie Plame. The magazine was also held in contempt in order to pay a fine of $1,000 a day. Like Cooper, Tim Russert of NBC's Meet the Press received a subpoena in May. But unlike Cooper, Russert agreed to cooperate. In a statement, NBC said Mr. Russert was interviewed under oath by prosecutors on Saturday. A Washington Post reporter, Glenn Kessler, was interviewed by prosecutors in June. A second Post reporter, Walter Pincus, says he received a subpoena yesterday. We're now joined by a reporter who's been one of the leading journalists on the story of Valerie Plame's outing from the beginning, David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine, author of the book The Lies of George W. Bush. Welcome to Democracy Now!, David.
Hi, Amy. Good to be with you.
Can you talk about the significance of what is happening now, one reporter after another being questioned and Matthew Cooper refusing?
Well, it's important to understand that reporters apparently are being questioned or their testimony is being sought by Pat Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in the case, I think for different reasons. If you look at Tim Russert apparently had a conversation with Scooter Libby, who is the chief of staff of Vice President Cheney, and a lot of the leaks, the quasi leaks that have come out in the investigation indicate that Fitzgerald has spent a lot of time looking at Libby as a possible source of the information that outed Joe Wilson's wife Valerie Plame as a CIA officer. In the Russert case,
Libby and Russet both have said that Libby had a conversation with him, and Russet agreed, and Fitzgerald wanted to ask Russet about that. Libby waived his confidential rights with Russert, so Russert could tell him what happened in the conversation. And by Russert's testimony, it wasn't related, or it didn't include the outing of Valerie Plame. It wasn't related to that. So that was the Russert agreed to answer very, very limited, specific questions about a conversation in which Libby said, "Go ahead and talk to the prosecutor about it." In the Matt Cooper case with Time Magazine, on July, the Novak column came out on July 14th, 2003. On July 16th, 2003, I was the first reporter to note that the Novak column, which contained the leak about Valerie Plame, was possible evidence of a White House crime. The next day, Time Magazine and the second story on the subject wrote that some government officials, that's a quote, some government officials had disclosed Ms. Plame's identity to the magazine. Matt Cooper wrote that piece, and so it's obvious that Fitzgerald now wants him and Time to identify who are those government officials. It's a much more central, essential matter to the investigation. Matt and Time are saying, we're not going to do this, we're not going to reveal our sources and say who it was who told us this. So this gets to the heart of the case that Fitzgerald's trying to make, trying to discover who was it that leaked the information.
Now, let's remember that Ashcroft, the attorney general, has recused himself. David Korn, if you can explain why this case was handed over to Fitzgerald.
Yeah. Well, because the CIA requested the Justice Department investigate the leak. Because it was focused on the White House, it was thought, and I think reasonably so, that John Ashcroft, who is a political appointee who answers to the White House, should not be in charge of should not be overseeing the investigation. So he recused himself because of his closeness to the White House and to Karl Rove and others who might be targets of the investigation. And James Comey, who is the deputy attorney general, then handed it over to Pat Fitzgerald. They call him a special counsel. Technically, he's not. A special counsel, according to Justice Department rules, has to be somebody outside the Justice Department. He is a U.S. attorney in Chicago, so he is employed by the Justice Department. But he does have a reputation for being independent. We're outside with our noses pressed against the window trying to get a sense of what his investigation has been doing. And the signs are that he's been making a real stab at finding out what's going on. He has a good reputation as being a good investigator who doesn't get involved in a lot of politics, so maybe he actually is, but it's still unclear how much progress he's making, and certainly if he's going to Time Magazine and Matt Cooper and others and saying, tell me who your sources are.
What do you think?
It may be an indication that he hasn't been able to make a case otherwise.
What do you think reporters should do with some reporters speaking to prosecutors, others not?
I tend to think that if you're a reporter and you promise confidentiality to a source, you got to keep that confidentiality, unless, of course, you're talking about preventing a murder from happening or something extreme. And if you go back to your source, or if your source says, I release you from this confidentiality agreement, as happened in the Russet case, then it's fair to talk about it and say, this is what happened. But it seems to me, there's another step here that people often lose, and that is when Robert Novak first reported the story.
We have 10 seconds.
Yeah, he could have said the story is that the White House is trying to destroy Joe Wilson and not put the leak through. He could have flipped the tables on them, but he chose not to do that.
David Korn, thanks for being with us of The Nation magazine, his book, The Lies of George W. Bush. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, go to democracynow.org. Our producers are Sharif Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, Anna Nogara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, and Nell Geiser. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Uri Galed is our director. Tonight, I'll be at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue at 8 o'clock with Jim Hightower. Next week, Berkeley on Wednesday, and then on the weekend, Eureka and Hopland and a number of other California places. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.